The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Broadcasting live and video streaming live from our studio, which hopefully in the next 4 weeks you'll see our new studio, which is 2,000 square feet, 25 foot high. It's beautiful. It's being built as we speak. And you'll be able to see all the different hosts, Danny Schechter and all who broadcast live from the New York office in that new studio. It'll be as big as Fox Studio, so it's nice to know that an independent, progressive studio is able to challenge them, at least on the aesthetics of the set. Today, no guest. Instead, I've decided to spend more time opening up our phones for you to call in on the issues that are important to us. Now, two issues I'm going to share with you today. One is from Sarah Jaffe from Alternet. They got bailed out. We got sold out. How the banks profit from the lack of jobs. And then Jesse Jackson, the short one, we ignore poverty, but it's on the rise, from Common Dreams. Also, for those of you who believe that we should be positive, as I do, in the face of what seems insurmountable objects, every day we can do something good for ourselves and by extension the world. So today I'm going to play in a few moments the words of a young 13-year-old girl who is able to tell the truth to a world conference down in Brazil. She's from America, and I want you to hear what she has to say. So for those who think, oh, it's only out of adults, or only those who are politically connected, only those who are on the inner circle of these sanctums of conservative or liberal think tanks and policy centers that wisdom comes, no, it can come from a very young person. Her truth is searing. You'll hear her words in a few moments. But also, let's do two things today that are very positive. First, please call Governor Cuomo and tell him no to nuclear power. Close down Indian Point. Now, we've sent him the documentary. Every member of the New York legislature has the documentary knocking on the devil's door, as, by the way, Governor Christie and every legislator in New Jersey and the governor of Connecticut and all the legislators and Governor Jerry Brown in California and all the legislators. So now they have facts. We've also sent them links to hundreds of articles from leading scientists, nuclear physicists, showing that virtually every pro-nuclear argument we have multiple rebuttals to. We will strip down the lies surrounding this facade that nuclear is green, that it's sustainable, it's inexpensive. It is not. So we are making our move. Now, next week, I will announce our next step, and our next step is to get 500,000 people on signatures, petitions that we're up on GaryKnoll.com now. Please sign that, because that's a petition that will be taken by a legislator in New York that represents the District of Indian Point. And that legislator, who attended the showing of Knocking on the Devil's Door, and it's her district, she will personally present that petition to the state legislature and the governor. So we are going to make a difference. Now, that's on one level, so that's something good we can do. Then, I would like for you to call your U.S. house member and tell them no. Tell them H.R. 1489. This is House Representative Bill 1489. The Return to Prudent Banking Act of 2011. That will reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act. It was introduced by, I believe it's Marcy Kaptur, on April 12th in the House of Representatives. It is sitting in the Financial Services Committee with 35 co-sponsors. So we, the people of the United States, we want this Glass-Steagall Act. That was the only thing that protected us from casino capitalism that went amok. We want it reinstated. So please call your House, write your e-House member, and say, yes, support 1489, the Return to the Prudent Banking Act of 2011. So that's two things you can do today to make a difference. And remember, you do make a difference. Let's go to some of the latest on health and healing. First up, Laughter Lift. This is from the University of South Wales. It says, humor therapy is as effective as widely used antipsychotic drugs in managing agitation in patients with dementia and avoids serious drug side effects. This is a new study published in the National Dementia Research Forum. This is the first major study of the impact of humor therapy on mood, agitation, and behavior disturbances and social engagement in dementia patients. And by the way, as an aside, throughout civilizations, everyone knows that laughter is one of the best medicines. I love laughter. I grew up in a household of all men, except for my mother, and we laughed until we ached every day, mainly putting each other down. It was nothing but fair game. And, of course, I got put down the most because there's Gary, the little rabbit. He's eating that grass again. You know, if I didn't want iceberg lettuce, I was considered, you know, strange. But that's all right. I took it all in good spirits, and that's why I have the humor I do, and I laugh at everything. And so I believe that we should do a lot more laughter. We take ourselves too seriously. Yes, there are serious issues, but there's plenty of time to rebalance that. And I want to thank all the people who came to our dance party last night. Did we have fun? You bet. It was packed. It was a beautiful crowd, the most enjoyable people. I can't tell you how much joy I had. I was laughing. It was fun. It was great dancing. And you dance and you have fun. It also liberates your energy, and it's very healing as well. In fact, I got an email today from someone who was talking about their crippling condition they had, that taking the train and in the subway and the stairs where they could hardly walk. And they got on that dance floor, and today they have no pain for the first time in years. And they said, you were right. Get out, liberate your energy, laugh, smile. So, we have a lot of people who have dementia and don't know it. Let me explain what we're seeing. Just this past weekend, I counseled a person who is very well known and very well liked. This person came to me because they're currently on a lot of meds for what was supposed to be just the what this person said, oh, I'm just at the very beginning of dementia, and then proceeded to forget within 1 hour and repeat themselves 5 times. This isn't beginning dementia. This is advanced dementia. After that comes Alzheimer's, and then it's over. And nothing this person got from the so-called best doctors, the most famous neurologists, is going to help them at all. So I'm putting him in touch with Marie McGovern, who has reversed 95% of her advanced Alzheimer's, as proof what can happen. What was interesting to me was how people don't want to see the truth of where they're at in their health or their life or the choices they've made. If we understand that virtually all of the choices we've made, we become the accumulation of all those choices. But it's confusing. I'll tell you why it's confusing. Because you can work really hard, and you can have some successes and achievements and graduating yourself up some ladder of life, but that doesn't mean you're happy. It doesn't mean you're coming from your spiritual side. It doesn't mean that you're joyful. It doesn't mean that you're selfless. It doesn't mean that you care about other people who have less. It doesn't mean that if you walk down the street and see a poor person, that you're connected with them on some level, realizing there's another human being. And therefore, the grace of the Almighty, I could be that poor person on that street, hoping someone looks at me with some compassion and says, friend, here's what I have in my pocket. So what happens is we only look at ourselves in a mirror and write a story of our lives that focuses upon the ideal that we like to see within ourselves and not the reality of what we are. And so when this person was telling me about themselves, they didn't want to acknowledge that the stress in their life, the enormous amount of insecurity in their life, had led them to making choices where the stress creates cortisol, imbalances the hormones, depletes the natural energy, destroys mitochondria, absolutely drains the adrenals, imbalances blood sugar, and causes oxidative stress, all of which attacks cells and neurons, and that causes what we now call dementia and the amyloid plaques. Instead, to look at that broad-based picture and acknowledge, gee whiz, yes, I've not lived the best life I should. I've not lived in balance. I've been compulsive. I've been obsessive at what I do. I've tried my hardest to do well so that I will be loved or respected or accepted or acknowledged because growing up I didn't. They don't say any of that because that's too painful. Instead, they just focus upon what they've achieved. And they keep coming back to that over and over again. That's their story. They don't want to write any true chapters about what they did that allowed them to get to where they're in a crisis. Financial crisis, relationship crisis, health crisis, obesity crisis, dementia crisis, the environmental crisis, belief system crisis. That's what they're not going to have in their chapter. That's what they're not going to see in the mirror. And yet, when this person left after, I guess it was 2 hours I spent counseling him, didn't have a single supplement. Instead, I said, you got to change the underlying conditions upon which your future rests. Don't think this person's going to do it. Hopefully they will. Now I ask you, how many people in this audience have forgotten to look at your life as if this isn't a dress rehearsal? This is it. When you're young, you don't care. Because you wake up one day, you've been on binge drinking that night, you stayed up all night, you've got a cell phone in one ear that's surgically implanted, you got a computer 3 feet from your eyes 24/7, you're twittering, you've got titanium thumbs. You don't care, because no matter what you say, no matter what you do, you will not look or feel different the next morning. But you will look and feel different 15 years from then, or 20 years from then. Will you take responsibility? A smart person looks ahead and says, the likely outcome of the choice I'm making is, and then you fill in the blank. So if each day you can find something to laugh about, if you can rent a funny movie, if you can look at yourself and find humor in yourself, and if people don't laugh with you, that's okay. They'll laugh at you or you'll laugh at yourself. Laughter is important. Laugh more, heal more, live in balance. Look at the choices you're making, because every single choice you make will have a consequence. You just don't know when it'll be and what the outcome will be. High pollution levels linked to increase in heart attack risk. One more reason, this is from the British Medical Journal, one more reason why you had better pay attention to the pollutants in the air and the water you drink. Hence, a more sustainable, healthy environment is going to help you live a longer, healthier life. Let me quote this. High levels of pollution could increase the risk of having a heart attack for up to 6 hours after you've been exposed to any form of pollution. Well, how about that? This was done at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, where they studied 79,000 heart attack cases in a 3-year period. And the higher the pollution levels, carbon monoxide, nitrogen dioxide, sulfur dioxide, SO2, and ozone, the worse it was. Think of all the people listening right now from L.A. Man, you are living in a toxic stew out there. So there is a consequence to this. Oh, by the way, last night I had five different fellas come over to me who we took pictures together, and they were just as happy as can be. They're all cab drivers. They didn't know each other. One was from Nigeria. One was from Belize. The other's from Haiti. And they said that they tell all the other drivers. And all the drivers right now, if you went into a cab right now in New York City, and if you're driving in a cab from someone from Haiti or some of the other tropical islands, there's a high probability they're going to have this program on. They're very hip. They're way ahead of the curve. They're aware to wear little deozonators that will trap the particulate matter in the air around their neck, or put a filter in the cab. You can put it in a cigarette lighter, and that way it detoxifies the cab, to sit on a magnetic seat cushion that helps protect the kidneys from the jarring that's common on city streets, to take antioxidants so that it helps them with the background pollution that they're going to be breathing, all the car fumes. They're very aware. Yet who would think to ask a Haitian cab driver in this elite snob city of intellects that they know more about health than the bankers, the professors at Columbia? Yeah, they do. They're way ahead of the curve. Buyer beware. Advertising may seduce your brain, researchers say. Now, this is from Science Daily. Let me, and this is reported in the Journal of Neuroscience and Psychology and Economics. Quote, are you wooed by advertising? Of course you are. After all, it's one thing to go out and buy a new washing machine after the old one exploded, quite another to impulse buy that 246-inch flat-screen TV that just maybe, in hindsight, you really didn't need. Advertisers come at you in two ways. There's the just-the-facts type of ad called logical persuasion. This car gets 42 miles per gallon. And then there's the ad that circumvents conscious awareness called the non-rational influence. A pretty woman says, draped over a car. The mind then says, ooh, if I buy this car, pretty women will be draped all over it. Hello, fellas. Have you ever seen a really hot woman come up to you in your red car and say, I just got to get in the other seat with you. Oh, and I'm going to get undressed in the process. I don't think so. Not in your fantasy, not in your lifetime, but boy, when you watch those ads, you'd think so, right? Well, despite the research surrounding the notion of neuromarketing, which studies consumers' cognitive response to marketing stimuli, the impact on brain function of these types of real-world advertisements was unknown. Now, researchers at UCLA and George Washington University have shown that different types of advertisements evoke different levels of brain activity, depending upon whether they use elements of logical persuasion or non-rational influence. And this was reported. Do you remember about 10 years ago, Calvin Klein came out with an ad. Nice-looking guy, good, strong body, but he had a pair of underwear on, briefs, and it showed this bulge. How many guys do you think went out and bought that underwear thinking, if I wear these underwear of Calvin Klein, somehow I'll magically grow my anatomy? Again, I don't think that happened. But why else do the ad? What was the purpose of the ad? What could possibly be the purpose of an ad showing some guy that looked like he had a partial erection wearing underwear? Does it mean the underwear are going to make you less soiled? I don't think so. Less drip? No, you're still going to drip. But what's the purpose? It's that subtle psychological influence of us projecting something beyond the reality of what we're buying. And that's most of what we get when we buy something anyhow. And finally, power corrupts, especially when it lacks status. Now, this is something new. And boy, does this fit. This is from Science Daily. It's in the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology, done at the University of California, Stanford, and Kellogg School of Management. Listen to this. Ever wonder why that government clerk was so rude and condescending? Or why the mid-level manager at your company always doles out the most demeaning tasks? Or on a more profound level, why the guards at Abu Ghraib tortured and humiliated their prisoners? New research found that individuals in roles that possess power but lack status have a tendency to engage in activities that demean others. According to the study, the destructive nature of power without status, the combination of some authority and little perceived status, can be a toxic combination. Let me see. How about SWAT teams? How about a lot of police? How about bureaucrats? How about traffic cops? How about a lot of people who have power and little status? And man, do they use that against us. I was thinking this morning, I'm going to create a new radio show. We have five new ones that I've created recently. I'm still looking for a host for the documentary hour. It'll be a program focusing strictly on progressive documentaries. And we'll have all these progressive documentaries. And so I don't have a host. If anyone wants to be a host of that show, you'll let me know. But there, we're going to be focusing on probably two documentaries per week, but that have social relevance for solutions, not just scary stories with no solutions. But then I came up with doing a show on government accountability. And I'm now going to look for someone to host the show. Here's my idea. And I'll just give you, I'm not going to take more time than this. I believe that both the left and the right have it partially correct, but substantially wrong. What do I mean? One side says that big government that employs a lot of people and gives them a living wage and security, that's the ticket. The other side says, no, we got to eviscerate government and strip it down bare. The less government, the better. That's what we need. And I ask them both, have any of you done actually any scholarship to see what government we actually need? I think what we should do is start with a more fundamental premise. What do we need someone to do for us that would help us, that helps us become safer, more secure, facilitates positive change within our lives? That's the government that we need. Now, how many people are needed to do that? And then, what accountability standards do these people have so if they're not doing that work correctly, that they can be held accountable? They can be reprimanded or fired. Oh, unions don't allow that. So if you work for the government, you're in the government union, you can do anything, no matter how bad you are, no matter what crimes against humanity you commit, you're protected. Well, then the union is counterintuitive and counterproductive to the needs of the society. So for those of us who are pro-union, we say there has to be an entire reformation of thought on that. Otherwise, we just end up with a lot of people running unions who are corrupt, selfish, greedy, no different than politicians. In fact, they are politicians, even if they came from the rank and file. And it becomes self-serving. So you mean in a democracy, everyone should have equal opportunity to negotiate unless you have this powerful union that can buy votes, in which case then you don't have to negotiate because the power of how you got into position is the politicians know if they do anything against you, they could be out of office. Well, then what is democratic about that? That's just another form of extortion. But we don't like to look at it that way. That makes it too black and white. It makes it too real. There's too much truth in that. So let's get to the way that we can diffuse all that. So then we have gigantic bureaucracies like the military-industrial complex, the Department of Energy, the Department of Education that says, give us more money, give us more money. And we're saying, hold on a second. We spend more money on education than anywhere else in the world. New Jersey spends the most of any state per student. And look at the level of illiteracy, so it's not more money you need, it's a different way of educating, which means we have to be honest. We have to look at what the system is, the layers of bureaucracy, the layers of nepotism, the layers of management, the layers of administrators, the layers that have nothing to do with actually educating a child. Now, the teachers know this. None of them are dumb. They're not all highly literate, but none of them are dumb. The student also knows they're not being taught what they need as the tools to help them. Just getting everyone to pass a test is oxymoronic. It doesn't mean you've prepared anyone for anything except taking tests. Ah, but that's the whole idea. If we can show that all of our students got a certain grade, then we get more funding, we get more respect. but did you actually graduate a student that can learn how to survive and thrive and grow and contribute to the real world? No, that's irrelevant. The student is irrelevant. The student means nothing. The teachers mean nothing, except that they can be called upon to make sure which politician to vote for, because that keeps them from having to ever do anything like teaching the way they should, and it keeps those teachers who know how to teach from teaching the way they should. It works both as liberating and a imprisoning factor. So we have good teachers who can't teach good. We have bad teachers who can't be fired. We have students who are not being educated in how they should be educated, and we have a completely illiterate society today. They don't know history, geography, psychology, philosophy, ethics, morality. They don't know how to think. We are not teaching children how to think. We're only teaching them how to test out on a particular topic that will be irrelevant later. Oh, that makes a lot of sense. That's the details I'm talking about. Do we even have the desire to do the minutiae scholarship of examining each of the things that we, the people, fund that become permanent bureaucracies that grow exponentially and become more powerful, and therefore you can't do anything with them? But one side says, oh, but we created this, and therefore vote for us. And the other side said, well, we're going to cut all this out. Well, what if you cut out what we need? What if you cut out rules and regulations and protections that we need? You're trying to get rid of the EPA. We need the EPA. We need protection over our water, our highways, our skies. So there is the nuance. We don't have anything in place right now, and we haven't for decades, that actually determines what do we actually need and how should it be governed, managed. It does not exist in any agency of the government. Not from your legislators, not from the White House, not from the Supreme Court. They're a bunch of whores, the Supreme Court. We all know that. And it's embarrassing to me because they lack intellectual honesty and discipline. They're nothing more than a bunch of paid-for mouthpieces jurists. That's all they are. And they gave us Citizens United. But we don't have the decency to say that. So we have an entire government that's out of control. And it must be stopped at every level, at every department, at every agency, but not going in randomly and with a madman's idea. Instead, you go in and say, what do we need? Let's keep what we need, and let's let the rest go and make it accountable. Because right now, we have a fascist military police state. Any one of us who are in any way concerned about our government, who belong to any organization, we're under surveillance. We have files on us. That shouldn't be the basis of a democracy. You never hear that talked about. I'd like to see what Rachel Maddow or Keith Olbermann do if someone gave them their FEMA files, their national security files, and what they had planned for these people, what they're looking into. What would they say on the air then? Oh, you mean it's me that they're talking about? Well, then it's an issue. I see. That's a very selfish perspective. So you're only interested in something that affects you directly, but not the rest of the world. So I'm going to be starting a whole new program, not me. I'm going to get a host that's going to talk about government out of control. Government out of control. We need government, but we need a government of the people by and for the people. Right now, we have none of that. We have a government for special interest groups. We all know that. And don't be a liar. Don't be a liar and say, oh, no, that's not true. Then you might as well go over to the dark side, because that's where you're at. We have no control over any agency of government. We have no control over the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. We have no control over the FDA, no control over the U.S. Department of Agriculture, no control over the Department of Education. We have no control over the Defense Department. We have no control over anything. But the people in power do. The special interests do. Corporations do. The people in those corporations do. So it's their government, not ours. Then why would you vote? Why would you dare vote for Barack Obama? Haven't you got it yet? Haven't you at least awakened? How many more excuses can you make? You continue down this line, trust me, you will not be happy with the outcome. And then who are you going to blame? Then we get back to that, I cannot look for the truth of the improper decisions in my own life, because if I did so, I would not have then to feel comfortable about all the other decisions I made that I refuse to take responsibility for. It's much easier to blame someone else or some other belief system for the mistakes I made. Okay, fair enough. At least we know where we're starting. But for those of us who are of a mind to hold people accountable, organization accountable, try to get them changed, we are engaged in it as we speak. And now we see why so many bureaucrats can be so reprehensible. Arresting a man who had too many vegetables growing in his backyard in Michigan. What kind of person would do that? Exactly the kind of person who has power, but doesn't have the prestige. So they take it out on people. We have an awful lot of masochistic people, sadistic people, working in governmental agencies at every level. Now for our issue of the day. This is from Sarah Jaffe, and I'll quote it. It's short. Then I'm going to ask you to call in and share your thoughts. Amidst a lot of indicators that say we could be heading for another round of recession, hello, we're in it now, before the so-called recovery even reaches most people, let alone our millions of unemployed, we saw a consumer jump in borrowing, three times as much as expected, according to Bloomberg News. $15.5 billion increase in credit was the biggest in the last 4 years. That's called revolving credit, which includes credit cards, and it went up an additional $5 billion just in that period of time. In a consumer-dependent economy, that's a good thing, isn't it? After all, borrowers must have some confidence in their ability to pay back their debt, right? Not so fast. During the debt ceiling drama, we heard a lot about the need for the government to live within its means, comparing the government spending to a household shelling out money for unneeded things. The analogy didn't work out too well. Imagine a household spending half of its income on defense, for instance. But it had another purpose. It reiterated the idea that working Americans, burdened with debt, were themselves to blame for their financial woes. Just live within your means, the argument goes, and you won't have those pesky credit card bills. Of course, that's not even close to true. In an economy in which real wages have been stagnant or even in decline for years, credit has had to make up the difference. Banks and credit card companies have profited off the rest of our country's debt. America is a nation whose growth in recent decades has been predicated upon a model of consumption. From a nation that used to save to one that invests, we now borrow to consume. When credit froze up about the after the financial crash and working people could no longer borrow to spend, the economy took a hit. It doesn't take an economist to tell you that spending isn't back to where it was before the crisis. But here's the deal. So why is there a jump in buying on credit if people still don't have money to spend? Hello? This is what Carlos Alexandria says. The most logical interpretation is that as other sources of cash are drying up, jobs, equity lines, consumers are now turning to credit cards for basic living expenses. And as credit lines become exhausted, another round of defaults is in store. Some may say the cash sales are not reflected in the data, but the American way of life and the core economic engine has been plastic because for as long as we can remember and is not about to change in time soon. In other words, a jump in consumer credit is not a sign of confidence, but of desperation. Quote, when you look at an unemployment above 9%, housing prices not coming back, that will impact the mood and consumer confidence. In the end, what all this means is that people are using their credit cards to buy food, to pay electric bills, to pay for a car payment. People are not using their credit cards to go out and buy luxury items or buy consumer items. They're just using it to survive. And they're having to kite, meaning they'll have 10 credit cards. So when one bill comes in for $3,000, they pay that with another credit card. And then when that one comes in, they pay that with another one. That does not mean we have a growing or reviving or healthy economy. It means we are a debt-ridden economy. The American public is on the ropes. The banks, they get out of jail free. The banks are not only getting out of jail free and getting trillions of dollars in interest-free loans, they're charging exorbitant interest to the American consumer, both on their credit card, their debit cards, on their student loans. So let me just put this in final perspective. You think the Democrats and Republicans, with rare exception, like a Dennis Kucinich or Ron Paul, do you really think they have anything in common with you or your interests? They don't. All they do is continue to allow derivative tradings to the hundreds of trillions of dollars, 600 trillion and counting. They allow trading in commodities essential life, oil, water, gas, futures in all of our currencies, and food. Hence, you can manipulate the price of a food up, which means people will go hungry or starve to death. But someone up in Connecticut whose wife is going out this afternoon to buy another Chagall or Picasso on her credit card for $20 million, that husband can gloat, "We just made another $5 billion today." Yeah, and how many people starved to death because of it? We don't talk about the morality of how we make our money. Wall Street Journal doesn't talk about it. Fox News doesn't talk about it. Hannity doesn't talk about it. The Democrats don't talk about it. Bill Clinton doesn't talk about it. He's one of us. We've given him $173 million since he left office as president. We've given his foundation $800 million. We don't talk about it. No, the well-dressed Democrats don't talk about it. You won't hear us talking about it. We never equate. You never challenge George Soros and how he made his money. It's blood money. Trading in commodities like currencies where people suffered. And it's very simple. Give some to liberal radio programs. Oh, that you'll never hear a peep. Give it to some environmental programs. You'll never hear a peep. I see. So that's how the game is played. That's how it's played. Okay. Your thoughts. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I'm Gary Nall. Your turn. We're going to be back in a moment. Please stay with us. You're my number one DJ. Oh, my number one man. I can't lose with the song you do. Get me up dancing. Get me on my way. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Going to be taking your calls in a moment. Don't forget, Sunday night from 8 to 9 p.m., only health and nutrition and healing. No guests, just you and I spending an hour together getting people well. Monday evening, 7 to 8 p.m., it's going to be a two-hour special this week. I couldn't get all the guests together this past week. This week we have them together. Let me tell you about what will be one of the most important shows you will ever hear. We have a two-hour special this Monday evening, 7 p.m. These are people who are going to be jurists in a special 9/11 panel. Ian Henshaw, the British investigative journalist, will be there. Barbara Honington, former White House policy analyst and senior military affairs journalist, and she will be there. Peter Dale Scott, he is University of California, Berkeley professor, former diplomat in Canada. Professor Paul Zumbraka, economic professor at SUNY. Annie McCone, former intelligence officer for the British M15, who addresses how intelligence agencies like the CIA work in concert with the media to conduct cover-ups. Professor Lance DeHaven Smith, professor of public policy at Florida State University, who's been specializing in what has become known as state crimes against democracy, or SCAD, the fabrication of evidence. Ted Muga, a veteran professional pilot who has raised the fundamental doubts about the official commission's explanation on how the planes were hijacked and the flights themselves. Niels Herrett and Kevin Ryan. We are going to have a phenomenal two-hour panel, and the criteria is they can only enter evidence that challenges directly the official report, and it must be independently verified prior to coming on the air. So it's taken us a long time to prepare for this program, plus new information on how we can prove that the Saudi royal family was fully aware and probably complicit in 9/11. So this is all new stuff. You won't want to miss it. Tell your friends now, Monday evening, 7 p.m. Now, one more thing. This coming Sunday, we're going to introduce you to Denise's Natural Products. Denise and her husband have retired from the New York City Police Department. They're still young. They put in their 20 years, and now they're starting a new career as homesteaders. And this is something I've been encouraging people to do. I've worked with them. I've gone over 100 times the different products till they really perfected them. And she has done magnificently. She has created her own cosmetic lines and food lines and did it from scratch. Everything from the bottles, the labels, the products, the testing. And she's going to be at Uptown Whole Foods at 89th and Broadway. Uptown Whole Foods, 89th and Broadway, Sunday from 1 o'clock till 6 o'clock. She'll have samples of her product there, and you can talk to her about homesteading, all right? If they can do it, you can do it. So she's prepared for the future. She and her husband have a whole new future of wonderful creativity, getting back to nature, and a lot of you I know are interested, so now you have a chance. And I'll be up there, too, in the afternoon because I want to see the people come in, and she's there to talk about how they did it, and how you could do the same, too. One final thing before we go to your calls. I have a special, and two things. First, for the first time, I'm going to be offering my brand-new book. It's just out. It hadn't even been put in the bookshelves yet. If you're watching over the video at GaryNoll.com, you'll see it's called Death by Medicine. This is brand-new and just out today. And you also get, with Death by Medicine, the book, you get Death by Medicine, the multi-award-winning documentary. In fact, we believe it's the most winning documentary in the world thus far this year. We've been a finalist or official entry or wins 50 times this year, and there's still several months to go. You get both of these together, the book and the video, for $20. It's going to be, in a month, $65 for the package. You get it for $20. So you will find this a lifesaver. You'll see things you never thought possible in the video and as well as information in the book. Call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, to get, for the first time, available direct to the public, Death by Medicine, the book, brand new, just in today. Won't be in the bookstores for another 2 months, but we have some here in the office. And the video, the DVD film, the director's cut, Death by Medicine. Both together, $20. You're saving $45. Next up, we've been out of this for, I guess, 4 months. It just came in this morning. It's the wonderful Ageless Answers, what I use. It's funny, last night I was standing up on a little platform because I wanted to sign books, and I didn't want to be in the way of people dancing, and so I took the furthest place in the nightclub, but there was a very bright light there. And I was standing under this, and people come up and take pictures. And this woman comes up, and she looks at me, and then she takes her hand. She's taking her hand across my forehead. And she says, "You don't have any wrinkles." I said, "No, I don't have a wrinkle." She says, "Your skin's tight." "Yeah, it's tight. I take the right nutrients. This is my hair." And she does a whole examination on my hair and head and the hands. She says, "This is scary." I said, "Why?" She said, "Because I was in your class when was it, 1975? She was in my class at the New School for Social Research." And she says, "Man," and she said, "I got to do." And I said, "Well, hey, you've had all that time to do the right thing. Now you got to look at what you've done and see what you can do to change." Well, one of the things I do is I use my Ageless Answer every single night before I go to bed. And I massage it in to my skin, my neck, hands, my forehead, everything. And I suggest you do the same. Now, I want you to look around at all the different anti-aging creams and facial creams. And then I want you to take a look at my skin renewal cream. First, I defy anyone to show me a cream that is manufactured under the strict conditions mine is. Improving moisture and hydration, reducing the appearance of fine lines, augmenting firmness and smoothness, increasing cell turnover, protecting from free radical damage, and soothing and healing. Why? What's in that? What's the number one ingredient, which is the dominant ingredient? It's the organic aloe barbadenus aloe vera leaf, the whole leaf. Then I use an herbal infusion of purified water. I use Siberian ginseng, but the Eleutherococcus sinicosus extract, the purple carrot extract, the red clover. I use the isoflavon extract of soybean. And then I use a different type of fermented soybean, the glycine soybean, simbenacine lysate extract. And then I use a shiitake mushroom extract and a maitake mushroom extract, the Ganoderma incidentum. I use the metofoam seed oil. And the glycerol, I use the vegetable glycerin and the blue-green algae, the red marine algae, the vegetable algae, the rose hips seed oil. I use coconut oil, Chardonnay grapes seed extract, ascorbyl palmitate, the fat-soluble vitamin C. I use the phosphatidylliptids. And that's just half. Coenzyme Q10, borage oil, evening primrose oil, retinol palmitate, vitamin A, beta-glucan, lycopene, and natural, beautiful natural vanilla cherry essence. Nobody does this because, A, they couldn't afford to. You couldn't sell in the market today a product like this because I know what we go to, and one of the reasons it took 4 months to get it back in stock is because all the ingredients weren't available. We have to wait till something is grown and harvested before it goes into a product. This isn't some chemical concoction. This is the most vital, healthy product I know of in the world because I created it. And I don't compromise ever on anything I do. So this, you care about your skin. You care about your knees, your hands, your neck, your face. You will go to bed each night by massaging this and smells wonderful. And here's the deal. Today, you buy one, you get one free. Buy one, ageless answer, get one free. And it's in stock, but we only have 500 jars in stock, which means 250 people, which is not going to be enough for everyone. But I can only make it in small batches because I can only get the ingredients in small batches. That's the difference of making the best quality 4-ounce big jar ingredient for your skin versus just doing it commercially where you can make 1,000 tons of this stuff and sell it cheaply, but it's garbage. I don't believe in selling people garbage. I believe if you're going to do something, do the best you can, and it should be the best. It should be the standard that no one else can touch. And that's what I believe Ageless Answer is. So if you care about your skin, call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. Sorry, we've been out of stock for 4 months. It's now back in stock as of this morning, but only 500 jars. Buy one jar, get one free, and it's 4 ounces. Now let's go over and say hello to some of the people standing by. Let's say hello to Bob from Queens. Hi, Bob, you're on the air.
You're the best. It's been a long time to you. I try to do a lot of things I can. But, Gary, you know, and poor people, they try to keep themselves healthy, and they can't afford, you know, the things that you've got. Is there alternative medicines that they can take or alternative things they can do?
Okay, let's dissect this, Bob. First, thanks for calling in. I appreciate your question. It's a good question. Now, what if I were to rephrase your question for you? Here's what I would say, and see if this makes any sense to you. When I first came to New York City, I had $12. I came on a Greyhound bus from Parkersburg, West Virginia. I didn't know anyone. And seven of those $12 was stolen when I went into the restroom to wash up and to shave. And then when I put my jacket on, someone had taken the money that was in my jacket, so I left with $5. And the next day, I'm sitting on a bench in Central Park. It was June 5th. And I remember there was music from the Plaza Hotel across the street from where I was sitting. And I'm thinking, okay, part of my mind says, wow, I'm broke. I don't have a nickel. I don't have a job. I don't have any food. What am I going to do? I better go back home. I'll make a call. They'll Western Union me money, and I'll go home. The other part of me says, all right, so I don't have any money, and I'm poor today, but I'm not going to think I'm poor. I'm not going to look poor. I'm not going to act poor because that's a state of mind. I'm still capable of doing things, and hey, if I don't know anyone, then everyone I meet, it becomes a potential new friend. And that's how I went about it. So my first night in New York City, I slept on a bench in Central Park, and with not an, you know, with $5, but I'd use some of that money to take a subway uptown and then back downtown. And the next day, I walked around enjoying the city. I walked all over Central Park, really enjoyed Central Park. And then I found a place I could be a short order chef. The guy says to me, can you make a Spanish omelet? I made a Spanish omelet. Can you make a French omelet? I made a French omelet. And I'm a good cook. My mother owned a little restaurant called Butch's Luncheonette. Butch was her nickname. Her name was Blandina. And so I was able to get food. Though there wasn't a whole lot in the restaurant I could do, so I bartered. I made my food that I wouldn't eat, and I took it out, and I took it down the street, and there was a place where I gave them my food from the restaurant, and I got stuff that they had that I liked, and I could eat. So slowly, and then when I had enough money, I stayed at the YMCA on 34th Street, because you could get a room there for $3.50 a night, and you could get breakfast. And I ate a big breakfast because I didn't know what else I was going to eat that day, so I loaded it in. Over the next 2 years, I learned that even if you are poor or limited, it doesn't mean that you have to be limited in your resourcefulness. So I would go to a supermarket, and I would watch them, and they always strip down most of the outer leaves of a head of lettuce and throw it away. So I simply said, hey, instead of throwing that away, can I have it? And they said, sure. So I'd take big black garbage bags, and I'd take all this stuff that was perfectly edible. Not a thing wrong with it. It might have been a day old. So what? It might have had a blemish. Who cares, right? I grew up where there was a farm where you got scabs on apples. Nobody cared that the scab was from a worm eating itself out of the apple and left a scab behind. So it didn't affect the taste of the apple, but nobody wanted to sell a non-perfect-looking vegetable. And I would take those bags, sometimes four or five bags, down to a soup kitchen at a church, and I would give it to them. And what I had left over, I would go back and I would juice, and I'd make a stew. And I had some buddies who were poor, so each night we would have a nice meal that I would make. And they, you know, they were hungry and they were happy, and it was tasty, and it was fun. I ended up writing a book called Surviving and Settling in New York on a Shoestring. And I showed all the ways we second-acted plays, where we wait till people come out of the theater, and then we'd go in and find a seat and sit down and enjoy it. The same way with concerts. So nothing was ever limited, as long as we realized that we were resourceful. Now, to bring that around to your situation, we assume that because we don't have actual cash in our pocket, we are limited. We are not. If we're willing to look at what constitutes a healthy diet, you see that a healthy diet is one half the price of the average American diet. Now, granted, there are some supplements that you're not going to be able to use, but you can compensate by all the grains, legumes that you can buy in bulk, which are very inexpensive compared to what the average person is consuming. So if you take a pound of beef, let's say at $4 a pound, and you take a pound of brown rice at 73 cents a pound, you have an enormous savings. And yet you're getting 100 times, not 100 times, excuse me, you're getting a 100% more volume out of the rice, because when you add water, it bulks up. So you're getting fiber and B-complex, you're getting endosperm and nutrition that you're not getting in the quality. You're not getting any fiber. You are getting B-complex and B12 in the meat, but you're getting too much protein. So a poor person's diet's the healthiest diet. It's just that we don't think about it. If you buy a pound of potato chips, which would be about five bags, because they're about three ounces each, you're paying $15. If you buy a pound of organic potatoes, you're paying about 80 cents. So you're looking at enormous savings by buying the organic potato. And if you watch what you put on it, if you put flaxseed on it or olive oil on it, and good seasonings and raw garlic raw onion and sauteed garlic, you have a delicious meal. Now think of what you have if you eat potato chips. Saturated fat, sodium, unhealthy. Here then is the key. We have to be very conscientious about the choices we make. So first, go to a food co-op. You're going to get about 20% discount on many items. Then go to your local health food store and ask them, instead of throwing away all this material, could I have it? Even in the juicing, the average health food store that juices throws away, on average, 3 big bags of the what was juiced that day. That makes perfect compost material. You can use that to make your own garden richer. And then ask them about taking anything they'd throw away because it's not aesthetically perfect, and you can take that home. So those are a few of the things you can do that will make a difference. Now, as long as you're juicing, you're getting phytonutrients, you're getting antioxidants, and if you juice 4, 5, or 6 times a day, you're getting far more than the average person taking supplements would get. So don't feel that because you are limited in what you can spend financially, that you're limited in the nutrition you can bring into your body. It's called compensation. You're compensating. Hope that addresses your question there. Thanks a lot. I appreciate your call. Let's say hello to Michael from California. Michael, and then we have Paul from St. Louis. Michael from California.
Good morning.
Hi.
Just found your radio station, and I'm really impressed, especially that long thing you just did about health. That's really sensible. I mean, it's something that is really relevant right now. Whole bunch of people don't have any idea how they're going to get along.
Well, what I do is I try to provide tools for people to survive.
Yep.
And as long as we realize it's we are together, not me, not you, but we. And we've gone too long by living as separate tribes, separate guilds, groups, unions, political parties. We've forgotten what it is to be a race of human beings cooperating together.
The whole culture is designed to counteract that because it's based on advocacy and competitiveness. That ties into the basic thing you were speaking at before, and that is just the whole structure is get yours. And if you can manipulate the rules and regulations so that you're allowed to do things, then you do them because, of course, it is to your benefit. That's all the lobbyists. Originally, the concept they had, in the consultation and so on, they set up all sorts of limitations and rules and regulations trying to control, the bad word, capitalism. And that's fine. Socialism has this big problem in that I used to be a socialist, but it doesn't work very well because we're too focused on getting ours, and so we don't think exactly what you're talking about. Hey, what's for the better good? Let's get mine. I'm going to manipulate these things to my benefit. And I don't know how you get past this concept of get yours to some sort of a global thinking or even a local thinking.
We're running out of time, Michael, but I appreciate your input. How we get there, and you'll see this if you continue to listen, and I hope you do, is that we have to stop thinking through the ego, and we have to start looking at a problem and what is the long-term consequence if we do it the way we've been doing it, what will change. And I believe that we cannot continue to think that way. We have to think more universally. Is this a universal truth or is this an individual truth? And our individual truths, we think selfishly. If it's a universal truth, we think of the outcome and the consequences to everyone else. Thank you very much, Michael. And I want to thank all of you. We have Danny Schechter's just walked in the studio. Hi, Danny.
Hey, you know, everybody, you missed something if you weren't there the other night to watch the premiere of or a screening of Gary's new film and a panel, high-powered, high-emotional and political panel that followed that Gary conducted. It was quite brilliant, I thought. You know, I mean, we had some of the top people in the whole anti-nuclear movement, including a family that came from Fukushima in Japan, who had eyewitness testimony, but with so much pathos and pain, and children who were evacuated from their homes and what they were going through because of the dislocation of this crisis, you know, motivated by, you know, an unsafe nuclear plant and, of course, the tsunami and earthquake. So, you know, it was a chance for New Yorkers to interact with people who've been working this issue for so many years, and yet while everyone was sort of in a agreement. There's been so few forums like this, so few panels which talk about, you know, what's actually happening on the nuclear front, what's happening at Indian Point here in New York State and elsewhere. So I just wanted to congratulate you, Gary, for having the vision to do this. I mean, I'm sure people thought you were crazy to do an event from starting at 5 and running till 9:30. I mean, you know, it sounded like a telethon, and yet people came, they stayed, they were fascinated. The audience was a very diverse New York audience, which is unusual given left-wing events tend to be all white, you know, activist types, and this wasn't. And I was just really honored to be part of it in the audience, watching it and watching the response, not only people talking about your film, but, you know, people wanting discussions like this, wanting to be part of something, angry, frustrated, and you know, having something like this was really an indication of the interest that exists, the demand that's out there. You know, we need a theater. We need a space to be showing our work and organizing events like that. And I was very taken with it. I'm sorry if I'm gushing on here. But
no, I appreciate it. Danny Schachter, of course, was there. And I acknowledge Danny in all of, not all of his work, because there's too much to acknowledge. But to let people know that we had a wide diversity of people. For too long, people in progressive movements have wanted one question answered. Can we make a difference? And yes, you can if you organize, if you work together, subordinate the ego to the larger issue. And that's what's going on. In 2 weeks, we're going to be demonstrating in front of the governor's office. We have the person that represents Indian Point in the New York State Legislature who's on our side. The governor and every member of the legislature has a copy of the film. Also true in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, and California. And we are going to do campaigns and petitions. So, Danny, yes, all those frustrated people will have a positive way of expressing that. And all we're going to do is focus on Indian Point. If we close Indian Point, as Carl Grossman and others have commented, we can close any other nuclear plant in the world.
Well, I just would like to, you know, say I'm happy to be back. I've been in Istanbul in Turkey, a country that is becoming a major regional, perhaps world power. I had a lot of interesting encounters there. And, of course, there's a lot going on with Turkey and Israel and the Middle East that I'm going to talk about in my show, which is coming up next. And we're also going to hear from Naomi Prinz, the writer, the former banker with Goldman Sachs and Bear Stearns, who's going to come on the air and talk about this economic crisis. I didn't see what's going on in the market today, but yesterday, you know, it dropped 500 points. We're in, you know, on the edge or the verge of an economic collapse, and it's important for people to know it. We're also going to hear from people on Wall Street or part of this Occupy Wall Street encampment that I went down to visit the other day. So that's coming up on News Dissect
Radio. I just missed you. We were down there filming.
Okay.
You were down there. Once again, we're going after issues that are important and relevant, and we're not just debating it amongst ourselves. We're moving forward. Danny Schachter, coming at you in 60 seconds. Please stay tuned. You'll enjoy this program.
Gary Null Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Tappenfeld.